the panel on truth, assertability, and the escape from the obscurity middle continues with a lecture by Marian Bali from the University of Graz, entitled The Idealist Master Argument.
So here we have Kant. What is truth? The nominal definition of truth, that is the agreement, Übereinstimmung, could also be correspondence, of cognition with its object, is assumed as granted. The question asked is, as to what is the general and sure criterion of the truth of any and every cognition? For us here, this search for a general criterion will not be important. That seems to be pretty wild anyway, for a general criterion for the truth of any cognition, right? That's usually discussed in this connection, but that won't be very important for us. Here's a passage from the Yeshe logic, from the introduction. Truth, it is said, consists in the agreement of cognition with its object. And note, in the critique he has said, and I agree, that's the definition of truth. Truth, it is said, consists in the agreement of cognition with its object. In consequence of this mere nominal explanation, my cognition, to count as true, is supposed to agree with its object. Now I can compare the object with my cognition, however, only by cognizing it. Hence, my cognition is supposed to confirm itself, which is far short of being sufficient for truth. For since the object is outside me, the cognition in me, all I can ever pass judgment on is whether my cognition of the object agrees with my cognition of the object. So first, side remark, or introductory remark, note that Kant in this passage is not arguing against the correspondence theory of truth in the sense of against the correspondence definition of truth. What he does is he questions its utility as a test for truth, as finding out whether something is true, as a criterion of truth. He's not proposing a coherence theory of truth. You might even say on the contrary, look at this passage here where he says, hence, my cognition is supposed to confirm itself, which is far short of being sufficient for truth. Right? So this sounds like actually he would be against the correspondence theory. Right? But this is not... the coherence theory, thank you. This is not really our topic, but interesting as a background information, because there were fairly early on, Kantians who interpreted Kant as having advanced a coherence theory. Windelband, for example, famously, and Brentano corrected him about that and so on. So there were discussions on this score. For us, the interesting point is that even though this is not actually an argument for the coherence theory, one can, and I would say many have tried, to extract an argument against the correspondence theory of truth from this sort of passage. And actually, in particular, a transcendental argument against the correspondence theory. This argument is transcendental because it proceeds under the assumption that truth is known, actually slightly weaker, that truth is knowable. So this is right, every transcendental argument needs to have such an assumption somewhere. We can do this, we can have experience, we can know things, and these are the necessary conditions, the conditions of the possibility of, and so on. Right? So this has this form, the argument. I call it the idealist master argument, where I don't want to put any weight on idealist. You can also read, if you want, anti-realist and so on. So these sorts of positions. So sometimes it's also referred to as the comparison argument, which tells us more about its content, but less about its intended impact. Before we go to this argument, one little reminder, again looking back to Kant, look at how he says here, truth is the agreement of cognition with its object. This reminds us, or should remind us, that there are actually, historically speaking, two interestingly different types of correspondence theory of truth. The one I call object-based theories and the other fact-based. Object-based theories basically say something along the lines of a judgment is true just in case it, the judgment, corresponds with its object. Note, there's a background Aristotelian judgment analysis here, subject and predicate analysis. The object of the judgment is the referent of the subject term. And there's a real relation here. Its object, the its here refers to a reference relation. And the judgment, usually what is meant here is the predicate of the judgment has to correspond with the object of the judgment. So that usually means has to correspond with properties, at least some properties of the object of the judgment. So we actually have two relations here, a correspondence relation between predicate and properties of object, and the reference relation that says here is the object of the judgment. Note, interestingly, that this is how Kant talks. So actually, what I'm going to do, because I'm going to look more, I'm going to suppress these issues, I'm going to look at more modern fact-based theories of correspondence theories. I'm going to suppress this a bit. This is sort of going to be submerged a little bit. But if one is interested in these things, it might well be of interest to study issues like that more on the object-based correspondence theory line that Kant himself presupposed, than on this more modern 20th century Russell and Moore fact-based correspondence theory of line. So here's the fact-based correspondence theory. It says something along the lines of a belief is true just in case it corresponds with some fact or other, right? Only one relation is mentioned here, correspondence. There's no talk about its fact or anything like that, right? As long as a judgment belief corresponds with a fact, it is true. I've deliberately switched from judgment to belief, just to remind you, to indicate that in the older days, it was more typically to do definitions of truth for judgments, sometimes for ideas or so, but usually for judgments. Very awkwardly, Kant typically talks about Erkenntnisse when he defines truth, right? He has this weird use of the term Erkenntnis, where it sort of means what the subject would consider to be his or her Erkenntnis. It's not supposed to entail truth, right? Sort of seeming Erkenntnis or something like that, right? I suppress that in that quote, as many translators do. Kemp Smith does this too, which is why the word Erkenntnis didn't show up in the passages I cited earlier. It's confusing. It's much better to translate it as cognition or something more neutral. And I deliberately put belief for the fact-based theories because in the 20th century that would be a much more preferred notion than using judgment. So this is a little reminder that there's a temporal issue a little bit going on here too. Please note also that as such, these theories, or the, let's call it the correspondence theory, even though it's a whole family, right? The theory is not really as such committed to realism. You can see this immediately by us adding the assumption to the correspondence definition that maybe the objects in question or the facts in question are all mind-dependent. As soon as you get that, like you would, for example, have in MacTaggart, you would have an idealist, anti-realist correspondence theory. Or if alternatively you were to interpret the notion of correspondence as being dependent on what we believe corresponds, right? On what we think corresponds, as soon as you do that, again, you have an anti-realist type of correspondence theory. Right? So the correspondence theory in this thin sense is just the theory based on just these sorts of definitions, does not by itself carry, by my lights, any real logical commitment to realism. Of course, it carries a strong Gricean implicature of realism. Usually, things like that are advocated by realists. Usually, one thinks, of course, the correspondence is to mind-dependent or mental, to mind-independent, non-mental facts. Of course not, right? No correspondence theorist should be crazy enough to say that a belief is true only if it corresponds with some mind-independent fact, because, of course, we can have true beliefs about beliefs, and then, of course, these would have to correspond to mind-dependent facts and so on. So things are a little bit complicated to actually spell out how realism exactly works here and idealism and so on. Actually, in a way, idealism is easier to spell out. We're not going to be worried about that. Let's take a correspondence theorist who actually wants to be committed to realism, who takes these definitions as realist correspondence in the correspondence sense definitions. Okay, so let's go back to Kant and let me sort of do a summary of the what I call the idealist master argument. It has quotations around it, but these are fake quotes. This is made up by me in the hope that this should sound familiar to you, reminiscent of things that you have read often, repeatedly at many different places. We cannot step outside our own minds to compare our thoughts with mind-independent reality. Yet, on the realist view, this is what we would have to do to gain knowledge of the world. We would have to access reality as it is in itself, a phrase, by the way, that already shows up in Locke, it's not just from Kant, and in Newton too, to determine whether our thoughts correspond to it. So we would have to access reality as it is in itself to determine whether our thoughts correspond to it. Since this is impossible, since all our access to the world is mediated by our cognition, realism makes knowledge about the world impossible. Since knowledge about the world is possible, realism must be wrong. Note that this transcendental argument does not actually really require that we do have knowledge about the world, right? The argument by a reductio tries to conclude if correspondence realism were true, we could not possibly have knowledge about the world. So we only need the premise, but it's possible that we have knowledge about the world to make the counter argument go, right? So the anti-realist here doesn't really need to assume that we do have knowledge. It's enough that he or she assumes that it's possible to that we have knowledge about the world. This argument by Mielitz is extremely popular. Johannes just talked about Brentano. He mentions as one of his two main reasons for giving up the correspondence theory, this sort of argument. He spells it out a little bit. You find it all over the place in philosophers of very different persuasions, the Vienna neo-positivists, the Neurath, the leftist side, the Neurath side of neo-positivism would run this kind of argument repeatedly against Schlick, because Schlick was a correspondence theorist. Also Hempel would run this argument in his famous paper about the positivist theory of truth, which is also the paper that he later said he was very embarrassed about, and very embarrassed about the fact that it got reprinted so often and so on. You find it in all the pragmatists, from Schiller, Peirce, James, Dewey, repeated in many, many different ways. You find it in continental philosophers, Heidegger, Husserl, of course, only in his later phase, not in his earlier phase. Heidegger has a very nice, very clear-cut version of this sort of argument. You find it, strangely, even a sort of this sort of argument in Frege, which is very surprising, but there it's turned into an argument against the definability of truth, not for idealism. You find it in the successors of positivism, pragmatism, in the US mostly, in Putnam prominently, in Rorty, on almost every paper in various versions, and in philosophers like that of this sort of persuasion. So I forgot to mention Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and so on, right? So this is all over the place, to tell you a little bit of the background, this might be a good point. I have been thinking about writing a book on this for a long time, so I'm also interested in getting reactions of sort of how interesting this would be and so on. It seems to me part of the interest would be to find interesting historical installments, interesting different versions and nice versions of this sort of argument. Precursors, by my lights, there are two arguments which sort of in combination function as precursors to this argument. They're both by Berkeley. The first one, very famous, realism is incoherent because one cannot conceive a thing which is unconceived, right? You know, remember the tree that's falling without nobody observing it, can we imagine that, and so on, right? This is the sort of argument that then in later idealism got transmogrified and condensed into this nice little slogan, no object without a subject, right? Whenever you read that, that sort of comes from this Berkeley argument. And the other argument, also by Berkeley, realism leads to skepticism because only ideas can resemble ideas. By my lights, when you put these two together in the right kind of way, you get the idealist, what I call the idealist master argument. So exactly how this works, I have not laid out here, and I don't intend to do this because this would take too long, and I want to sort of put out the major points that I'm interested in. Okay, one thing one might ask to begin with when one thinks of these kinds of arguments, where does the idealist or the anti-realist want to take us with this sort of argument? So let's assume we did grant that this sort of argument shows that realist correspondence is untenable. So where does the idealist want to take us? So let's say he or she wants to take us to a coherence theory of truth. Then one should ask, how will a coherence theory of truth do when it itself is held to the standard set up by this objection? So then one has to ask things like, well, can we know whether a given belief of mine coheres with the coherent subset of my total belief set, right? So coherentism for truth, not justification, truth, right? Says something like a belief is true if it coheres with the largest, most coherent subset of my total belief set, right? So then if you run the same argument, you would have to ask, say, well, then in order to find out whether something is true, we have to find out whether it coheres with all our other coherent beliefs. Looks like for that to work, we have to find out what all our other beliefs are and how they cohere. This looks very difficult. However, nobody ever talks about this, really. Idealists do not tend to apply or even check their own anti-realist argument against their own theory, which they then advocate as a replacement idealist, anti-realist theory of truth. Okay, coming to the argument, I think it should be helpful to divide it into two main parts. There's a part A that says that there's something we cannot do, namely ascertain a correspondence between our thoughts and reality. And there's a part B that says quite a few things about what we have to do on a realist correspondence account of truth if we are to obtain knowledge. Interestingly, part A is the one that is more often talked about. So can we really not do what they say we cannot do and so on? Part B is not so often talked about. And so I'm going to start with part B to just put out some things that I think are worthy of consideration when one thinks about what the commitments are of the realist according to the opponent, right? So the opponent says the realist is committed to these sorts of things and they are all annoying, awkward, and so on. So the IMA, the idealist master argument, says if truth is correspondence, then since knowledge requires truth, we have to know that our beliefs correspond to reality if we are to know anything about reality. Please watch out. The idealist certainly does not want to say that we have to know the following proposition: our beliefs correspond to reality. The idealist means this for each and every belief. We have to know that it corresponds to reality in order for it to constitute knowledge. Right? So this is supposedly to be read de re, not the dicto, the tale of this conditional. This makes at least four assumptions. Of course, the number here, this is very much dependent on how you count. But these, I think, are four interesting assumptions that one might want to point out. First, as a starter, it seems to assume that S knows P only if S knows that P is true. This requirement, notice, even though it seems fairly benign, but this requirement is not, strictly speaking, underwritten by any analysis of knowledge, never mind what the justification part of the analysis of knowledge says, right? The analysis of knowledge says S knows P only if S believes P and P is true. It does not say that one also has to believe or know that P is true. It only requires that P has to be, as a matter of fact, true. Right? Now, this is not very horrible because if one believes and knows P, one can probably get fairly quickly to believe and knowledge that P is true. However, it's noteworthy that there's this step made because it might suggest that there's a confusion in the opponents on the opponent's side between knowing P and knowing that one knows that P. Right? If you require from knowledge that one not only that for knowledge one also has to know that one knows, then it becomes natural to flip back and forth between knowing P and knowing that P is true, because in knowing that one knows, knowing that P is true would of course be a requirement because it's one of the conditions on the view imposed. Okay, assumption two, much more interesting. What seems to be assumed is that if truth is F, so the idea is what I mean by this is if the property of being true, if the nature of truth is being F, if that is the essence of truth, then S knows that P is true only if S knows that P has this property, has the property of being F. So application, right? If truth is correspondence with reality or correspondence with a fact, then S knows that P is true only if S knows that P corresponds with a fact. This, I would say, is a fairly straightforward intentionalist fallacy. Compare, since water is H2O, but our ancestors did not know that, none of our ancestors knew that they were drinking water. So I would say, in general, this is a confusion between the definition, the essence of a thing, and the criteria for telling that something has falls under this essence. This is, in general, not required in order to know that something is present, even if it is a fact that this something, as a matter of fact, is such and such, I do not have to know that it is such and such, and that such and such and such is present. Think of this as a fairly straightforward application of Frege-type puzzles, right? You can know that the morning star is shining, the morning star is identical with Venus, that it doesn't follow that you must know that Venus is shining and so on. 5 minutes, okay. Is there maybe something weaker than assumption two in play in the argument? That's worth discussing, and I leave this as an open question. Maybe something along the following lines. A definition is acceptable only if the definiens is in principle utilizable as a test for the presence of the definiendum. And the anti-realist might be saying, but the correspondence definiens can never be used as a test for presence, so, and that's why it's bad. But of course, how the argument then goes would have to be spelled out, because that's not the same argument anymore. Stuff needs to be filled in. Okay, assumption three, S knows P only if S is belief corresponds with a fact and S has ascertained this correspondence. This is typically assumed in the ascertainment. Ascertaining here is by idealists in historically typically assumes to require absolute certainty. That's a kind of infallibilist requirement on knowledge that seems way too strong independently of realist, anti-realist debates. I simply skip this. Last assumption on this side, S knows P only if S has compared her belief that P with the facts, with reality. That's, of course, the most crucial term in the whole argument, right? That's why it's also often called the comparison argument. I would say the initial objection to this should be this is very strange. Much, if not most, acquisition of information does not proceed by any form of comparing in perception, in inference, in intuition, if there is such a thing. We do not compare any propositions or sentences or anything with anything. We just acquire information according to various machineries, processes, and so on, most easily spelled out in perception, maybe. But there's no comparing going on here at all. If you try to explain a little bit, characterized how we form beliefs and hopefully knowledge when we have perception or make inferences, the word comparing will never show up. It has nothing to do there at all. I think it's mostly just a bad metaphor. However, sometimes I would say we do compare. That's typically when we check, right? We already have a proper belief, we get worried about it, or something is put out by way of discussion. Scientists might test the hypothesis. There one can maybe speak of comparing. In these cases, these are certainly important cases, right? Checking is an important activity. But certainly it's way exaggerated to say that knowing is always the same as checking or having checked. We can know many things without having checked or without checking them by various psychological processes. 1 minute, still okay?
Yeah.
Okay. About the part A, that's the one that's usually much more often talked about. Notice that the argument, the idealist master argument, focuses on comparing cognition, beliefs, especially with reality, facts. One wonders whether the central claim doesn't equally apply to comparing anything with anything. So Kant is interested in comparing cognitions, beliefs with facts, let's say. What about facts with facts? If we need to cognize facts and to compare our beliefs with the facts, don't we need to cognize facts and cognize facts in order to compare facts with facts? Don't we need to cognize apples and cognize pears before we can compare apples with pears and so on? Things with things, I just mentioned. Beliefs with beliefs, doesn't this hold equally for beliefs with beliefs? Don't we first need to cognize our beliefs before we can compare them with our beliefs? Principle, consider this principle. We can never compare X with Y. We can only compare our cognition of X with our cognition of Y. Clearly, this gets a regress going, so there needs to be some heavy restriction on this, right? Typically, on the Cartesian epistemology, on the transparency of the mind, one would say mental states are exempt. We can somehow compare them directly. That must be the background idea, right? Which is not spelled out here. So obviously this must be restricted. Second, this would be the point to really get into the argument, to the main argument, which is not what I'm going to do. I'm just showing you how I lay out the issues. I would say the main thing to discuss here is the following idea. I can compare cognition one with, Kant says, I can compare cognition one with y only by, in some sense, using a cognition two of y, okay? But I would say it does not at all follow from this that what I am comparing is cognition one with cognition two, right? So I would go with things like, oh, I say I can touch you, and somebody says, yeah, but you can only touch me with your hand, and so you cannot really touch me because only, and so on, right? So I would say this is the same pattern of argument, right? I can eat muscles. No, you have to eat them by chewing them with your mouth, so you cannot really eat muscles, and so on. So this is where one would have to talk about, there seems to be a confusion here between the object of an act of comparing and the means of the of doing it, similar to a content object act object confusion in philosophy in general. Last slide, an afterthought about psychologism. The presupposed correspondence theory here, and I did this deliberately to stay within the framework, talks about truth of beliefs or judgments or cognitions or things like this. By my lights, this is off target. Once we have distinguished the state of believing something with its content, what is believed, we see that truth doesn't really apply to the state of believing. It doesn't really make much sense to talk about the state of believing as true or false. Really, what we mean when we talk about true beliefs is we mean what is believed, the content believed. So by my lights, a correct correspondence theory pertains to what is believed, what is judged, not to the believing, to the judging. So it would look like this: what is believed, the proposition that P, for example, or the mentally sentence that P, or whatever, is true if it corresponds with a fact. And now we have a non-psychologistic form of the correspondence theory. And now we have the question, how does comparing cognition with reality even begin to enter the picture once we've rewritten the correspondence theory in this way? We would now have to show, make new room for the comparison objection, because now, just from the definition of truth, it doesn't, can't even get a hold on what we're talking about to begin with. Thank you.